in China have always been tied to politics and to nationalism. And this can actually be traced back to the late Qing dynasty. During that time, we've seen there's evidence of Qing statecraft officials actually visiting Western parts of Europe to bring back a kind of model of tourism, model of museums, and specifically were described to how to be used as part of a national state, a part of a narrative of the imperial state, how to empower the imperial state. And this was brought forward as well in the Republican era as well, when collections were used to frame a very particular sort of visual narrative of history. Of course, with the ultimate aim of legitimizing the power at the time. With the founding of the People's Republic of China in 1949, it's also not surprising to know that the Chinese Communist Party extended this use of museums, and collections had a very strong political end. Very early on, the Ministry of Culture was established, and museums were very much seen as a way of instilling sort of a patriotic education, and in particular, espousing this very unilinear vision of history with communist ideal at the end of that history. Today, the situation is a little bit more complicated because there is ultimately an inherent contradiction. On the one hand, the state is supporting economic and social development across the country, and at the same time as this, that development is threatening and actually destroying a lot of the cultural relics and archaeological sites that are part of China's history. We just have to think of mass projects such as the Three Gorges Dam, for example, which flooded large amounts of cultural relics, which are now quite literally underneath the water. But at the same time, the state wants to actively encourage the preservation and protection and renovation of these same cultural relics and cultural heritage sites. So there's this interesting gap, how the state has to manage this, how to balance this, these two aspects. And it's for this reason why we see the development or the protection of heritage as a really sort of interesting aspect of Chinese statecraft. Now, of course, the context for this is part of a broader political shift in China, one that's largely, although not exclusively, abandoned Maoist revolutionary socialism in favor of more neoliberal policies. And that means the historical narrative that used to explain China's past at museums, the Maoist narrative of this unilinear cultural revolution, doesn't really explain the experience of people today, which is radical social and economic change, urbanization, etc. So the question then becomes, how does the state manage that change but still justify the ruling party? How does it justify the existence of the CCP? And that is to espouse and to promote cultural nationalism. Okay. And that's exactly why we can see heritage or becoming a very strong sort of political tool. And it's within this context that we need to understand the domestic tourism industry, which is by far the fastest growing tourism industry in the world. Okay. We have to think of recent changes in China in terms of rising incomes, emergence of a new middle class, freedom of movement across the country, but importantly, a renewed interest in China's own pre-communist past. People are genuinely interested to go out, explore their own country, understand their own history, particularly before the rise of the Communist Party. And we see this in the heritage and tourism industries. Today, there are around 3,000 museums in China. This number's growing all the time, seventh largest in terms of numbers in the world. From 78 to 2008, there was a sevenfold increase, and in 2014 alone, 151 new museums were built, which is equivalent to 2.4 every 2.4 days. So there's a sort of mass kind of push towards heritage protection, and museums are a really interesting sort of manifestation of that. Now, of course, ethnic minority museums are a really interesting example within all of this. So this really began with the founding of the People's Republic of China, right, and the formation of the Central Museum of Nationalities. And early on, the State Bureau of Cultural Relics was established, and this was at the time of the so-called Minzu Mapping Project, when state officials were sent out to border regions within China to map the ethnic composition of this multi-ethnic state. Ethnic groups had to register to become officially recognized, and state officials were sent out to actually work out how many different ethnic groups were there, and of course, far more ethnic groups registered that were eventually officially recognized, right? And the goal, of course, was to map the ethnic geography of China, but the role of museums and the role of collecting artifacts was, of course, really important. So many artifacts were collected at this time, brought back to museums, and, of course, that played a fundamental role in maintaining that early narrative of a unilinear cultural evolution. Now, initially, these objects were stored in the Central Museum in Beijing, but from the 1970s onwards, we see a lot of sort of local museums being built, local ethnic minority museums. And from the 1980s, even very large sort of museums at the provincial level in Hohhot and other regional centers. But it's really in recent years that we see the sort of mass ethnic minority museum building going on. So in 2008, 7% of museums were ethnic minority museums. By 2012, 14% were. And wherever you go, particularly in the south, southwest, but also in Inner Mongolia, you see new museums being built, museums being torn down to renovate them, make them bigger, make them more grand, and this is constant process. Of course, there's an economic aspect to this as well, because if you're reproducing, if you're reinventing museums, building new museums, you're employing labor, you're getting the wheels of the economy churning, and that's why, even up where I work, for example, when I went in 2007, there was a new museum built. By 2012, it had been torn down. Exactly the same thing built again, just much bigger, grander scale. Now, connected to this is a really interesting surge in so-called eco-museums in ethnic minority regions. This is a futurist kind of depiction of what some Chinese scholars imagine an eco-museum might look like in the future. And I've spent a lot of time in Beijing at the Minzu Boguan, the Center for Museum Studies in Beijing. And there's a really interesting kind of academic debate about the role of eco-museums. People talk about eco-museums. What can they do? How can they be implementing policies to do with ethnic minority groups? Now, just a little background to what is an eco-museum originally, if you don't know. So they originated in France in the 1970s, and they were guided by this really specific philosophy. Focus on the identity of a particular place or people. The whole idea was to empower local communities. There had to be a sense of local participation in the design and the execution of the museums. Importantly, they had to harvest local resources, being environmentally sustainable. But overall, the aim was to enhance the welfare of the community that these museums were said to represent. Probably the most characteristic examples, which one could argue are quite successful, is in New Zealand, for example, amongst the Maori, some of the pictures at the bottom, but also in places like Alaska and North America, Mexico, for example. You see some really interesting sort of community involvement in these museums. Now, in China, they've been reimagined quite differently. And that's as sort of living ethnic museums. So sites where actual communities live permanently, where there's housing provided, facilities provided, schools provided, basic infrastructure, and the idea is very much to have a kind of living museum. So one that's geared for the new tourism industry, but which at the same time provides modernized facilities and part of the sort of broader narrative of development. The first eco-museum was in Guizhou in 1997, and that was actually given funding from the International Committee of Museums. So there's part of the sort of broader idea here about connecting with the philosophy of eco-museums as we understand it outside of China as well. In Guizhou, we saw a really characteristic example, upgraded housing, infrastructure provided, all for the ethnic tourism market. And since 2008, eco-museums in ethnic regions have really sort of come up very fast, particularly in the southwest, but also where I work up in the northeast. When you speak to people who work in the academic study of museum and museum studies, basically the general consensus is that this is a sort of viable route on what we can do, particularly with small ethnic groups, okay? The idea here is part of China sort of building the new socialist countryside. Eco-museums and museums in general in minority regions are seen as a way of, first of all, overcoming that balance between cultural heritage protection and environmental destruction, right? So they're seen as an ecologically friendly, sustainable way, but of course also giving opportunities, economic opportunities, to small ethnic groups who, as people have explicitly told me, we wouldn't know what else to do with them. What else can they do, right? And this is where we come to a place where I work in the Northeast. So this is the recently renamed Alugoya Ethnic Reindeer Resort, formerly just Alugoya. And as you can see, it's a rather spanking, new, shiny settlement. So just a little bit of background on this area and who the people we're talking about. So as I said, this is Alugoya up on the Northeast, China's only reindeer herding community, 280 people. They entered Chinese, what was later become Chinese territory, crossing over the border at various times, coming in different clans. The most recent clan actually only entered in 1960, which is really sort of quite recent. But there was contact and flow across the Amur Heilongjiang River for far longer than that, of course. In the 1950s, the newly formed CCP, Communist Party, built a settlement called Alugoya, and the original Alugoya was literally up here, actually almost over in Heilongjiang province. And as I said, it was a sort of really rudimentary village. There wasn't really much other settlements around, and to be honest, people quite liked it. They were given electricity, they were given water, but half the community or so were allowed to continue to herd their reindeer, and about 1,000, 1,200, it hasn't really changed that much, in about 6 or 7 different campsites through the Chinese Taiga up in this region. And they were herding these reindeer primarily for as pack animals, and the main aim of the economy at the time was to provide pelts for hunting. So in the 1950s, the hunting economy was collectivized, and these pelts were provided to the state. A collective company was set up, and they were given initially ration cards and various subsidies back, but eventually monetary payment. Over time, due to deforestation from the logging industry, which gradually expanded north, hunting became less and less viable. And quite quickly, state authorities also realized, of course, that the antler of reindeer were incredibly useful for traditional Chinese medicine. Right? And so from about the 1970s onwards, the hunting collective was transformed into an antler cropping collective. So the antler are cropped every year. They would actually fall off naturally, but when they fall off naturally, they're too dry and they no longer have the blood capillaries inside them. Whereas when you crop them fresh at the height of summer, they're full of this what's called panti, which is essentially the blood capillaries and the soft velvet texture on the outside. Those can then be dried, sliced, and used for all kinds of different forms of Chinese medicine. So it's quite a painful process for the reindeer, as you can no doubt imagine. But they don't die; they're able to then reproduce the antler next season. So basically, this sort of interesting local economy emerged between state officials who were trying to find something for this very small ethnic group to do, but at the same time, through the settlement of the community in the original Alugoya, beginning to try to provide some kind of modernized facilities. Okay. Now in 2003, that Alugoya settlement that I showed you on the map was deemed unsuitable for the community to live. And the reason for this was climate change and supposedly the need for ecological migration. There were a large number of floods, quite dramatic floods in that region, as they've always been actually across the Amur region, and that was essentially used as justification. And as we all know, we've worked in China before, ecological migration, when you can justify that, then you have access to a certain pot of state funds, which allows you to not just relocate a community, but actually build a completely new settlement. And the new Alugoya, the name was just retained, was moved about 250 kilometers south, closer to the nearest settlement of Genhe, which is essentially quite a large city. In 2003. Officially, the local government had to get the permission of every community member to sign, but if you speak to people, nobody, of course, was actually gave this permission, except for a few people who no longer were tied to the reindeer economy. They were quite happy to move to upgraded conditions in the new settlement, closer to schools, closer to hospital. But also importantly, in accepting the new houses that were given, the rule was that they also had to give up their rifles, and a hunting ban was implemented in 2003. And that, for most of them, was actually the sort of the pinnacle of the move. That was the dramatic part. They'd always seen themselves as hunters rather than reindeer herders, and as people described, without hunting, we are nothing, right? Now, the interesting thing was, the initial idea was to relocate the community closer to the settlement and to pen these reindeer in relatively large compounds. People were quite reluctant to do this, but they initially did do it. And within literally just about 2 or 3 days, I was there at the time in 2005, a large number of reindeer started to get sick. About 3 or 4 started to die. The reason being, reindeer can't actually be fed on hay. They can't be fed on dried. They have to essentially eat reindeer moss that grows in certain height in the taiga. People broke open the pens and just essentially drove the reindeer back and reestablished about 6 or 7 campsites. The state recognized that that wasn't going to be a long-term solution, but it was allowed. It was maintained at the time. Okay. In 2008, a Finnish consultancy firm was brought in who specialized in eco-museum design. They specialized in this exact kind of museums, and they proposed to redesign the whole settlement as this Aloguya ethnic reindeer resort and to promote tourism as the primary form of livelihood for the community. You can actually get hold of the Finnish consultancy firm's whole report that they did. It's a sort of, you know, wonderful, beautiful, glossy document with great pictures and suggestions. One of the suggestions, interestingly, was to reinstate hunting as a kind of tourism activity. That was the only thing that hasn't since been accepted by the local government. But everything else was, even the design of the settlement, the location, etc. And it's kind of important to realize the economics behind this. So 200 million RMB, this is 20 million pounds, give or take, for a community at the time of 230 people. So it's sort of kind of astonishing when you really think about it. And as people often said to me, you know, we didn't have to do this. Like, we're not obligated to do this. So it is quite interesting to think just a bit about, you know, what is the ultimate vision of the state in terms of what they want to do or not do. And of course, the role of ethnic minority cadres is hugely important in this. And those cadres are almost exclusively not reindeer herding, members of the reindeer herding families at all. They're educated in Heilongjiang or even Harbin, for example. So we have a really interesting internal dynamic as well. This is what the settlement looks like today. So you've got this, actually, you can go to parts of Finland and see exactly the same housing design. So it's really, really interesting. But in the spirit of sort of this living eco-museum, you had hotels built, all the timber was harvested from the local forest, you had teepee tents erected around for activities like bonfires at night and this kind of thing. And you do get the sense that it was sort of quite well thought out from a certain perspective. There's a restaurant, there's a hotel, a huge hotel. The hotel houses, I think there's 250, 260 rooms, it's massive. And we stayed there right at the beginning, and it was totally empty in 2008. It was just sort of unbelievably empty. So even at that time, although all of this was sort of being built up for the new, the anticipated tourism industry, tourism wasn't really there, even in 2008, 2009. Right? Now, I've sort of been interested to look at this part of a broader transformation, and we also see this amongst other ethnic groups, such as the Orochen and the Hajen people, who also live up in the northeast. And there's this conscious effort to sort of market and promote this part of China as kind of China's Siberia, right? It's the only part of China that has this classic Siberian taiga. And that's a really important cultural resource for tourism, right? So just in the last 2010 to now, a really large number of protected areas have been established. And you can get maps of actually identifying where all the borders of the protected areas are. And it's quite impressive, I must say, you know, like when you take the amount of land that there is, the amount of protected areas is actually quite interesting and quite astonishing. And in those protected areas, there's no hunting, of course, but also no logging. There's reforestation activities people employ to go and monitor the forest. There's forest guards at night to monitor that there's no illegal hunting. So quite a lot of sort of effort is put in. And in 2014, only in April actually, the whole of the Greater Hingham Mountains was a hunting ban was implemented across the whole mountain range. And this was historically one of China's most important sources of timber, right? So that's quite a dramatic change, actually. Now the timber is coming from Russia, far better for purposes of ecotourism, right? So the point is this whole region, this whole part, this whole area, not just this small ethnic group of 270 people, but the whole region has kind of been transformed and readied for the ecotourism industry. And you see this in all sorts of interesting part private, part state-owned enterprises. So, for example, these sort of eco-holiday camps where you can book and you can stay, they have websites. Ironically, this is actually the location of the old Alugoya. So the place which was deemed too dangerous because of flooding, it's now one of the most beautiful sort of places to go on holiday. And again, there's this really interesting use of sort of quasi-traditional vernacular architecture in all of the designs. So I've been interested to look at whether Alugoya is a success or whether it's a failure, and it's a really complicated one to sort of understand, right? So clearly, unlike the eco-museums that I talked about amongst the Maori, for example, or in Canada, where you do have this sort of conscious attempt to incorporate local voices, clearly the situation is more complicated here. And that's mostly because the decisions were taken in a far more top-down way. Funding was allocated from central government to the regional government and implemented in that way. And as I said, it gets more complicated because of the role of these ethnic minority Evenki cadres, right? So it's a far more complicated situation. And most importantly, from a perspective of those families who still continue to own reindeer and herd reindeer, the main issues is that the reindeer economy hasn't been resolved, so they make relatively meager income from selling the antler, and the hunting ban is still in place, so officially people can no longer hunt. And the result of that is that pretty much 90-95% of the community receive government subsidies and are relatively dependent on those subsidies. So it's a monthly welfare payment, essentially, that comes in. But importantly, as I said, in the settlement itself, the housing is free, the water is free, the electricity is free, right? And of course, people value the benefits that brings, right? It's far more closer to Gunha City. You can get a bus is provided to take you to town. There's no longer a school in Alugoya. There used to be one in the old Alugoya. So of course, there's a bus now taking children to school. It's quite important. Connectivity, having internet access, having satellite TV, these things are all, of course, deemed important locally. But of course, this also brings about really interesting kind of new economic opportunities, right? From the tourism industry and from the relocation. So since 2010 till now, the number of campsites has gone up from 6 to 10. And that's because just around the new settlement, people have set up new campsites. And people who didn't even own reindeer before have set up campsites and are borrowing 20 reindeer from family members further in the mountains to market and to essentially enter the tourism economy. Different things you can do. You can have guided tours with people normally dressed in traditional Evenki clothing to show how we used to live, how we used to hunt. But you can also stay. You pay private households to stay in the tents overnight. And this, of course, has been marketed quite well, actually. And you've seen a steady rise of domestic tourism market coming to the region, right? At the same time, of course, it links back to the antler economy and the Chinese medicine market. Because now people know that if they go, they can stay, they can experience Evenki culture, and at the same time purchase this reindeer antler direct from the source. Okay. Now, of course, there's a really important variation within all of this. And there are those who are really kind of successful at marketing the new business. They've developed new skills and setting up websites, but of course others less so. And so there's new divisions that are emerging. Just a sort of different quote, it's nice to have a new house, but the settlement is like a zoo, right? So a lot of people absolutely dislike the settlement. When they go there, they drink heavily, there's fighting and all that kind of thing, which of course problematizes this sort of this vision of it being a sort of center for tourism. But so as I said, one of the things I'm looking at more recently is tourism itself and how particularly Han Chinese tourists are coming. What do they think about this region? What do they think about the Northeast in general? And what do they think about these small ethnic groups such as the Evenki, right? And then vice versa, what kind of performative element goes on between these two? And people talk about learning tourism or playing tourism. And again, we should bear in mind that this region didn't have tourism only a few years ago. So it's a sort of really interesting transformation, something to learn quite quickly. So I've had to look about tourism and anthropology of tourism and go back to sort of, you know, classic theories about tourism. And it's actually quite interesting the way in which it's different, but also similar. Okay, so the conventional theory of tourism studies is that the tourist basically is alienated from his or her life. They have an office job and they want to do tourism or go out to other parts of the world to experience otherness and to get away from their own lives. And this is definitely true in this case. But at the same time, there's no such thing as the tourist or tourism per se. There's different kinds of tourism, and tourism exists in different social contexts, but importantly within different political and economic contexts, right? And I think it's within this context that we have to understand this quite culturally specific sense of what the tourism encounter might mean. Chinese tourism in general is quite different, and quite a lot has been written about that, also in places like Inner Mongolia, Tibet, I'm sure as well. And there is a really interesting difference initially between group tourism and individual tourism, right? Generally in China, tourism is kind of group orientated, right? When you go to the Northeast, for example, you have quite large groups, 15, staying in the hotel together, everything is quite organized. Occasionally you may get a young Beijing resident coming up to sort of seek out exoticism up in the Northeast, but it's quite rare actually that you do encounter these individual tourists. More broadly, of course, tourism is particularly ethnic minority tourism. It has to still be seen within that narrative of the state, of state development and of nationalism, overcoming that dichotomy between promoting ethnic heritage, promoting cultural heritage, but at the same time promoting modernization and essentially change, which problematizes that ethnic heritage. So that's definitely a sort of underlying context to all of this, right? And just in general for us Chinese, I like to think of tourism as part of like Tianxia, right? China's the notion of China as a center with its margins. And when you talk to Han Chinese tourists in this region, they've never been to this part of China, and they genuinely are quite interested to see what's on the outer edge of the nation. So they want to go, they travel, often they rent cars in Beijing, and they drive for many, many hours, and they want to go to the border and see who's on the border, what's along the border, what is life along the border. And this idea of distance and sort of going to the outer regions of the nation or the empire. I think one of the best examples to show tourism in a sort of really interesting way is these ethnic minority parks, like in Guangzhou, for example, but also in northern Beijing, right? Which are these sort of microcosms of the ethnic diversity of China, all packaged within one site. And actually, when you speak to a lot of the people, they're not actually from those ethnic groups themselves, right? So it's a really sort of interesting depiction of ethnicity and the ethnic makeup of China. But again, as I said, I think we need to think of tourism in China as having quite a specific form, quite a specific political economic context. And that's because the way in which tourism is packaged is quite standardized, right? There's a particular narrative, not just a particular narrative about tourism, but there's a particular narrative of how tourism should work, how it should flow, how tourist sites are managed. And if you go to the Southwest and you go to the Northeast, actually there's quite remarkable similarities. The way hotels are constructed, the way people engage in that tourist encounter, it's quite well packaged. And that's, I think, part of this broader state attempt to control the narrative of what tourism is about and what can it do, but also what shouldn't it do, right? And again, that ties in with ideas of nationalism and preserving cultural heritage in the face of change. So in Alaguya, I think you can definitely say you do have the sort of very state-managed tourist experience, right? When you talk to particularly urban tourists, they come, they want to have their photographs taken with the reindeer, they want to talk to the hunters or the last hunters of China, get a sense of what is it like to be living in the forests, in the cold. People are so interested in the weather and how cold it must be and that kind of thing. And they do use sort of very romantic, classical notions about the last hunting tribe or this primitive tribe. So there's this really interesting dynamic that, of course, occurs between Evenki herders themselves, who probably actually, in this case, live in a brand new settlement and have web access, and then who engage with these Han Chinese tourists who expect them to speak back in a certain way and about certain things. So there's this really, really interesting thing, particularly generationally as well. Ecologically, of course, there's a really strong and interesting element as well. People assume that every Evenki reindeer herder is somehow in touch with nature, right? They would never throw a water bottle on the floor like we do, but of course they do. They would never burn trees without a specific need. They are animists, right? There's this clear sort of discussion about them being in touch with nature as opposed to us. So what you really learn talking to Han Chinese tourists is so much about what they think of themselves, what they think they've lost in the process of social and economic change. We no longer have that connection. Right? And of course that explains the need to go out to the margins and experience it firsthand. Right? So just these are just examples. So this is cropping of the antler, this is drying of the antler. And of course, photography is a really, really interesting and important aspect of the tourism encounter. And Evenki people will be asked to stage things like, oh, can you show me the saw and can you hold that pose? And the interesting thing is often, this is still a current aspect of local economy, right? So they have to crop the antler, they actually have to still do it. Most tourists visit in summer. So you get this interesting thing where local herders are quite annoyed at the fact that they have to show what they're doing anyway, and sometimes repeat a particular action for the tourist because his picture or her picture didn't come out right. So there's this really interesting dynamic, and of course gendered as well. Evenki men are hard drinkers, they're hard men, they're tough, they're brutal with their animals, they hunt. Women are beautiful, they smile, they wear traditional costumes and such. So you have this really interesting gendered aspect as well. But of course, around the settlement where the majority of tourists go, it needs to be different, but it also still needs to be comfortable, right? It still needs to be packaged in a way that you're not too far away from where your hotel is, for example. So they build this sort of wooden frames through the forest area nearby. You can stop and have a beer. You can talk to people. And it's really, really interesting with placards and that kind of thing. So it needs to still be comfortable. You still need to be able to get there, back to the hotel, back on the truck, back on the bus at the end of the day. These are just some pictures from around this. This is just 2 kilometers from the new settlement. Bizarrely, they have rabbits in a cage, and they also have pens like roe deer and that kind of things. This is the animals that were hunted in the past. And people come, I've seen people with having their weddings at the site. So, you know, with this winter wonderland kind of theme, sort of beautiful white dress, taking a picture with the reindeer and that kind of thing. But of course, all of this brings revenue. But of course, it would be wrong to assume that this is just simply about, you know, Han Chinese kind of abusing the poor ethnic group or something. It's not that at all. Evenki people you speak with are fully aware of the whole staged quality of their encounters. So they know how to perform. The men know how to appear strong versus perhaps a geeky Beijing student or something like that. So there's this really interesting dynamic where women will, they know that they are deemed more beautiful, for example. So there's this really, really interesting thing. And it would be wrong to assume that it's just a one-way power relation. But also importantly, there's a lot of benefits that tourism brings a small community like that, right? Not least income, right? So just in the last sort of 4 or 5 years, you've got quite wealthy families, actually. Tourism brings money. It brings also new opportunities. Like I said, you've got your free electricity, you've got your free housing, you've got your free water. And the more tourists that come, people come up with new ideas, such as the homestays, for example. And you do have really interesting gaps now occurring between wealthier households and poorer households, which you really didn't have even in 2005. But probably the most interesting thing that's happening, of course, is the situation of the reindeer, right? Because the state has promoted tourism and promoted China's last reindeer herding community so much, it's now absolutely crucial that the reindeer don't die, right? They have to now maintain the numbers, but hopefully increase the numbers. So it's become a constant state worry about the situation of the reindeer. So much so that you have local state officials from Gunho going to Norway and Sami land to learn from Sami reindeer herders, what kind of veterinary practices do you do? What kind of vaccinations do you give? Supposedly in a couple of years or perhaps next year, some reindeer will be imported from Norway to breed with Evenki reindeer to strengthen the gene pool, because essentially this group of reindeer are blocked from breeding with any wild reindeer in Siberia. So it's said that actually they're not particularly strong genetically, which is an issue. So there's about 1,200, and they want to raise it to about 2,000, which would be a huge change. But of course, from a local perspective, a local herder's perspective, it's a strong cultural resource to have, right? But of course, quite interestingly, through the process of tourism and through all of these interesting encounters, people talk also about tourism as having saved Evenki culture, right? People say, without tourism, actually, we wouldn't need our reindeer because there would be no need for us to be in the campsites, etc. And by having those four new campsites around the settlement, this has allowed those herders and those families who lived further up away from the settlement in those campsites to essentially do what they like. They're not involved in the tourism economy at all, but their family, through family connections, they get a lot of the benefits from tourism. They get more income, for example, than they did before. So I've just put this picture here to show you, when you go away from the settlement, this is essentially what it looks like, particularly in summer. So you just have these forestry tracks from the forestry industry. The only vehicles that are essentially allowed to pass in and out, and it's gated, are forestry trucks. Right? Besides that, the only people who really go up there are these small families of herder hunters. Right? So actually, they've got quite a vast amount of area to themselves. They also sort of occupy this interesting exceptional status. They're the only people who are officially allowed to harvest forest resources from the logging industry. That includes picking things like mushrooms, berries, for example, but also chopping down wood for fire. If a Han Chinese visitor chops down a tree, he'll get arrested, actually. Right? So it gives them a sense of entitlement to an area, to a part of the country, which actually they didn't have that sense only since before the tourism industry. Okay. And importantly, those households far away, of course, at nighttime and secretly, they can engage in hunting, right? And the reason being, because there's nobody else there, right? So they've actually got quite a large area to themselves. The issue around hunting is a complicated one, but essentially, through contacts with local government, everybody was allowed to get one rifle per household back after the hunting ban for protection against animals, wolves, for example. So this is just a map zoomed in on my Google map. So this is Hulunguya Highland. Kenhe is about here. The old Alugoya was about here, and that it was moved 250 kilometers. So this is where you've got the four tourism campsites, just here. And then as you go up the forestry tracks here, you have campsites, 1, 2, 3, 4, like that, scattered. And some of the campsites now are up here. And again, it's quite a large distance. Even if you take a jeep, it's a good five, six-hour drive.
Is that natural forest or is it all planted?
It's a combination of. So there's some areas which are relatively old growth, but quite a lot has been. But since the logging ban, reforestation projects have actually helped it quite a lot. Right? But so the point being, those campsites which are here are actually quite autonomous, which they never were before. So as I said, the tourism industry also gives people a sense of entitlement, but also all kinds of new forms of cultural capital. And because of the value of reindeer, because of the value of this last ethnic group, this hunting culture, etc., they're able to petition the local government in new ways that they couldn't before, right? One of the most important being they can now get free vehicle access from the settlement to the campsites. So they have to just make a phone call, the guy will come with a jeep, and the family will be brought up. They've got their phone up in the campsite, we also want to come back on Tuesday, the vehicle will come and bring them back and forth. Petrol is not paid. So again, it's quite an interesting sort of opportunity. One of the other things that has happened, which I mean, I've been looking at because we've been talking about eco-museums, is the upgrading of the local museums as well in the region. Okay, so this is another museum nearby, but very sort of very classic sort of period 1980s, late 1980s construction of the actual, so not the eco museum, the actual museum with artifacts, etc. But more recently, this museum has been built. So as part of what I said, how new museums are constantly being upgraded. But what's quite interesting in this example is that local Evenki museum researchers were brought in to design the museum. And this is a sort of interesting sense of local empowerment that, again, didn't really happen before. It's quite a grand sort of, you know, structure. People talk about it being a local museum. There was an interesting way in which all the objects were sourced. So essentially, these local Evenki museum specialists were given quite free rein to go to various parts of various villages around and collect artifacts, birch bark boxes, shamanic costumes, etc. And it's actually done quite well. And again, the wood is from local harvesting, etc., etc. One of the museum designers was given funds to travel to Scandinavia to go and see how museums were built there. He came back with all these ideas, of course, asked for funds. Funds were allocated, so you have screens with headphones. You can watch videos of Evenki history. Again, this is a 200-plus community, right? Quite a grand museum for a small number of people. This is a shop within the museum where you can purchase handicrafts, birch bark handicrafts. And again, because of the tourism industry, what's quite interesting is, of course, particularly young women now, that's what they want to specialize in, right? They want to specialize in craft production, clothing manufacturing. So you have this interesting teaching and generational teaching of skills that is going on, which again didn't happen only when I went there in 2005, 2006. They're now petitioning the local government to have these birch bark boxes and other forms of craft, but particularly sewing of rhodia clothing, to be recognized as a form of tangible cultural heritage, which is the idea being that it will be stamped and officially marked as an Evenki-specific product, because you can also get other birch bark, inauthentic ones. So there's this debate about whose is authentic and whose is inauthentic. There's quite a grand cinema to show films, but what's interesting with this one is that during the day you have films about Evenki history, and most of those films are from the 1950s when you have state ethnographers going and doing research and taking documentary films. But you also now have local filmmakers who are allowed to screen their films. So in June, one of the filmmakers is going to come to Cambridge, so you can come to watch the films. And actually the films are quite critical, right? They show alcoholism. They show some of the community members who absolutely do not like the new settlement, the ones who call it a zoo. And these films are shown in the new settlement. So there's quite an interesting thing happening, which I think it's about numerics as well. So there's an acceptance that 230 people are not going to splinter the country, right? 230 people are not going to demand that they be returned to Siberia, since they haven't been there since most of the 19th century. So how that internal critique is happening within the context of the relocated settlement, I think it's quite interesting. It opens up a space. When I've spoken to local government officials, people call it, they like to call it cultural democracy, right? So they say we can have cultural democracy within these spaces as opposed to political democracy. Another thing that people have been petitioning for, this elder, for example, she's really quite keen on making sure that young Evenki children learn local language, Evenki language. Language loss is a huge issue across ethnic China. And so now there's once a week, there's a class. She will go in and teach local children how to basic Evenki language. And all these interesting summer festivals with dance and music have been reinstated, which we didn't have in 2005. So you've sort of had this really kind of interesting reinterpretation, retraditionalization, reinvention of tradition, which at first glance we may sort of dismiss as a kind of, you know, artificial, but actually for local people, a lot of local people, it's quite a meaningful thing. In the summertime, you have young people, really young people, getting sent out to learn forest skills. Again, transportation is provided. They go out for 2 months or 2 weeks, depending on the age of the children. They live in the campsites. They learn from their, you know, uncles and grandfathers, etc., on how to be a herder, how to live in the campsite. I've spent some time when these children come. They come with their mobile phones and their jeans, and they're kind of, you know, ready to, and they're quite, you know, They've obviously spent time in school, and they're quite different to what they would come and experience here. But they sort of then take off the jeans and take off the clothes and put on the army clothes and the army boots, and then they say, okay, I'm now going to be a reindeer herder. And so there's an element of performativity as well amongst them. But what's quite interesting is by being in these campsites, and these are the ones that are quite far away from the settlement, that's when they get exposed to all the other aspects, such as the secret hunting that goes on. And now you have young 12, 13-year-old kids who love to go because they can go hunting at night, right? So you also have sort of new ethnic entrepreneurs. So you have an Alagoya musical, which has now been set up by and written and performed by local residents. This has toured across China. It's been in Beijing, it's been in Chongqing, it's been in Shanghai. The producer wants to try to bring it into Europe, which probably will happen. You have two or three novels which have come out just since 2012, fictional novels about reindeer herding and the reindeer herders. And all of this is serving, of course, to market the community, market the area, and thus the wheels of tourism continue to flow. So just in general, I tried to think about tourism as well and what the future of this, what the future of tourism will be. And in, when you go in winter, of course, there's this odd Christmasization of the area and reindeer use, and it's all quite garish, I guess, right? Is my natural reaction, right? It is, and it is quite, and a lot of local people think this is just a little bit too much. But again, what is tourism for? What is actually, how do we think about tourism? Without tourism, what would the situation be in that area? So it's something I myself have to constantly, check my own preconceived notions about what tourism should be or what it shouldn't be in an area like that. And as I say, is it possible to have a regular life within tourism, within an eco-museum, within a tourist setting? Hanging up your clothes on the outside, driving your motorbike to school, coming home, that's also part of everyday life, right? And as soon as it gets 5, 6 o'clock and the tourists go back to the hotel, life goes on, life continues. People have dinner, people go out, bring their reindeer back inside. So the gap between a tourist life and an everyday life is blurred. And I think it's interesting to think about some of these, given the fact that tourism is being promoted in such a strong way across ethnic parts of China, right? And not just in China, but in other areas as well, particularly amongst reindeer herding communities for some reason. So in Asia, the Tsakhn, for example, in northern Mongolia, in Hovsgol, I mean, the influence of tourism is going to be and increasingly quite important there. People already call it business Tsakhn, right? So in the summer, you go, you bring your reindeer down to Lake Hovsgol, you allow tourists to come and patch reindeer and take photographs. That gives you actually enough income to last until the following summer. So it's interesting, I think, to think about tourism as this encounter and what we might mean by tourism more generally.